Dear listener, we hope that you've been enjoying the variety of podcasts that we have on our network. Now is your opportunity to help us by telling us a little more about you. Please visit jcastnetwork.org/survey and complete our listener survey so that we can learn more about you and your listening habits. Again, please visit jcastnetwork.org/survey. Thanks so much.
Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finn, and we've got a great show for you. This is the beginning of the month of Adar, which is the month in which Purim is in, so we kind of do things a little bit sideways. That was the surfing paradise, Miserloo version, yes, indeed. In this half hour of the show, we will be interviewing Rabbi Elkanah Shmutkin from the Jewish Education Media. They just came out with a book called Early Years, The Formative Years of the Rebbe Menachem Mendel Schneerson, as told by documents and archival data. This is a tome, let me tell you, folks. The portion of the week is the portion of Teruma. It is to be found in chapter 26 of Exodus and follow. We have some very interesting insights into it. We have music of all sorts coming up sprinkled throughout the show. We have an exciting story at the end of the show. Stay all the way to the end. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Two Jewish brothers were abducted briefly and beaten severely by several men in a suburban Paris. One of the attackers sawed off the finger of one of the brothers. That's pretty heinous. 11 JCCs in the ADL headquarters in New York received bomb threats this week, bringing the total of bomb threats so far this year to 80. The FBI is still investigating. President Donald Trump finally denounced anti-Semitism the day after the threats. Alar Azaria, the Israeli soldier who shot a downed Palestinian terrorist, was sentenced to 18 months in prison for manslaughter. Azaria is appealing the verdict. South Carolina is the next state to pass legislation outlawing the BDS movement, that's boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. Under the statute, no entity that supports the BDS movement would be eligible for state funding or to work on state contracts. Here's an interesting story. You might know that there was a big tutadam in St. Louis in the graveyard over there. Two Muslim American activists launched a crowdfunding campaign to raise money to repair that historic Jewish cemetery in St. Louis. Linda Sarsour and Tarak El Masidi raised $100,000, largely by help from the Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling, who endorsed the campaign via Twitter. The original goal was $20,000. Close to 200 headstones were damaged in the attack, and Vice President Pence actually went and helped put some of them back. And finally, the Vatican and Rome's Jewish Museum are hosting an unprecedented exhibit on the menorah. They're not going to have like the menorah from the Vatican because nobody knows where that is, and from the temple. We had a whole thing about that. Whole show. The exhibit will run from May 15th to July 23rd and will be held simultaneously in St. Peter's Square and in the Rome Synagogue. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Hey, Shul Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. We have a little time for a little bit of music. This is Barry Weber. We've played him before. He's done this with Blue Melody. We've done them before. We never did them together, Ellie Weber and Blue Melody. And this is called Israeli Dance. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. 624-9800. Herschel Finman here. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. Our guest today, Rabbi Elkanah Shmutkin, the director of Jewish Education Media, known as JEM. JEM just came out with a book about the Lubavitcher Rebbe called Early Years. So with no further anything, how are you, Rabbi Shmutkin?
Thank God. How are you?
Good. Thank God. Thank God. There seems to be like tremendous interest in the Lubavitcher Rebbe in the last couple of years. This is like the fifth or sixth book that's come out. There's one that's being prepared, I noticed, by the editor of the Forward magazine is coming up with one next year. Why the interest in the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Elkanah?
I think that as the years pass, with every year that passes since the Rebbe's passing, his influence and the Rebbe's inspiration and teaching seems to grow. So the circle of influence is actually growing. A large part of that is because of the Rebbe's shluchim around the world, but the Rebbe's scholarships and teaching, they seem to be withstanding the test of time and people. You are correct that there's a tremendous fascination with the Rebbe himself and with the Rebbe's teachings, and I suppose it's because there's something there that's resonating with people, and that as the world around us seems to be becoming, you know, more shaky and more uncertain and unclear, when there's the Torah and its teachings are expressed and made relevant by such an incredible Torah teacher who actually applies it to people's daily lives, so people are seeking that out more and more.
So you're saying this is more than just a case of as time goes on, the person gets bigger?
Yes, as time is going on, the person is getting bigger in people's eyes because people are taking more and more notice. I don't know. I really sometimes I sit back and I think about this very question that you're asking. If we think back some of our great Jewish leaders through the years, did people at the time recognize, or even so close to their lifetimes, did they recognize the stature of this person in the context of Jewish history? And sometimes when you look back, I think the answer is no. It took sometimes generations until people noticed. And with the Rebbe, maybe it's because of the speed of technology, and maybe it's because of the way that the Rebbe taught and influenced people and had such a tremendous impact during his lifetime and the way that continues now. I think that people, you know, very quickly are turning around and saying, wow, you know, our generation had something special. That the Rebbe lived amongst us, and people are really trying to understand and to unpack and to figure out as much as they can about the Rebbe's teaching, the Rebbe's inspiration, and in this case, the Rebbe's life story.
Okay, so now tell us how does JEM function, Jewish Education Media?
Well, what we are is the video, audio, and photographic archives of the Rebbe. As well, we curate this material on a regular basis. We produce, translate, research these recordings and publish them on a regular basis. Our Living Torah is our flagship. It's a weekly video magazine. It comes out in English, Hebrew, French, Spanish, Portuguese, and Hungarian every week for, I think we're going on year 14 now. But we have many other videos, documentaries, biographies, that we put out, and as well we have a full-time staff dedicated to preserving and cataloging the vast amount of materials on the Rebbe's lifetime, and we have an oral history project, a major oral history project, with two full-time teams, one in Israel, one based in the United States, but that also travel around to document the oral history, the one-on-one interactions of how the Rebbe influenced the world, with an eye toward how it can inspire people today and what lessons people can learn from it and how they can, you know, continue to be, to extend the Rebbe's teachings and inspiration, you know, into their own lives. If you think about it, Rabbi Finman, it's the first time in Jewish history where the lifetime of a Jewish leader was recorded in audio and video. So we wake up here every day, and our whole staff, we have over 30 people that do this full time, and we feel like we're pushing the envelope, and I think we really are. And that's the first time in Jewish history that we have this tremendous opportunity that after the lifetime of a really, of a Jewish leader of tremendous stature, that we're able to kind of continue his, to help extend his leadership and his inspiration, and people are really taking to it. As you mentioned in the beginning, it really seems to grow, continue to grow every single day.
Mm-hmm. Cool. If you're just joining us, our guest today is Elkanah Shmutkin from Jewish Education Media. Jewish Education Media just came out with a recent biography called The Early Years of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So this one is actually from his birth, 1902 to 1929, which is the year that he got married. A lot of the stories that are here are things that have been transmitted and known because of the Rebbe's mother, who came to New York towards the end of her life, and she would tell stories about her son. So what did you find new, and how did you go about finding things to pique people's interest, Elkanah?
Just a word about the format of the book. The book is only a presentation of documents. We only use materials that are sourced in documents, as government documents, diaries, letters, school papers, etc. And we left the oral history for a different publication, or for some of our films or whatever. This is only things that are rooted in documents. And interestingly, there's a tremendous, that we found mountains and mountains of data. One of the things that I found very interesting is the home that the Rebbe grew up in. As a child in Dnepropetrovsk, the Rebbe's parents' home, Rabbi Levi Yitzchok and Rabbi Tzimchana, when he first came to the city, it was a Misnagdic city, it was not a Hasidic city, and they were really opposed to his being appointed chief rabbi of the city. There were many people in the community anyway. There's tremendous disagreement over it. And in the end, he was appointed rabbi in the city, along with somebody else, with a non-Hasidic rabbi at the same time. And within a few years, and so what happened is, you have this city which was a very cosmopolitan city. There were, non-religious Zionist eventual leaders of the State of Israel, and Hasidim and Misnagdim and religious observant Jews, non-observant Jews, etc. It was a tremendous mix of different types of Jews in this fairly large city. It's the fourth largest city in Ukraine. And within a couple of years, though, we see how everybody, literally everybody, including the greatest opponents of his in the beginning, they kind of turned around and they embraced them fully. And that was because of the type of home that the Rebbe grew up in. The Rebbe's parents had a very open, welcoming home. It's kind of like, if you see a shliach today, the Chabad representatives around the world, where, in cases you see that they're eyed kind of suspiciously when they first come to a city and say, who are these people that riding in their black hats and with their black hats and coats and whatever. And very often within a short time, people see, these people, yes, they're rooted in Torah and in mitzvahs, and they're very firm about their own observance of Yiddishkeit. But at the same time, and maybe because of that, they're tremendously welcoming and have open arms, and very often are embraced by the communities which they reach out to. So kind of the way I look at it is the Rebbe grew up in the first Chabad house, perhaps you can say. So that's the type of home that he grew up in. So I found that entire portion of the story very interesting, and it was news to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about the technique. Since in the last 100-something years since the Rebbe's birth, Ukraine has not exactly been a settled place, and there's been a lot of upheaval, and the documents usually wind up getting destroyed. How did you find all of these documents going back before 1929, Elkanah?
Okay, a large portion of the documents, or some of the most significant documents that we found, came from government archives. One of the people with whom we were working very closely over a period of, I'd say probably almost 5 years, is the director of the entire government archives of the entire region of Nikolaev. There's 50 different archives, and she's not Jewish. She was tremendously helpful to the project, and they really, together we succeeded in uncovering a number of documents that point to how the Rebbe's ancestors came to the city of Nikolaev. I'll give you an interesting anecdote here. The Rebbe's great grandfather, Rebbe Avram David Lavut, his mother's grandfather, the Rebbe's mother's grandfather, was brought to the city of Nikolaev by a Jewish shipbuilder named Sender Refalovich. Now, this Refalovich built some of the biggest warships for the Russian Navy. Mykolaiv is a shipbuilding town. And at the time, it was actually closed to Jews. But he was able to hire Jews for them to work, or ostensibly to work, in the Navy Yard. And he brought this rabbi, Rabbi Avraham Davalovitz, a tremendous Torah scholar and author of halachic works. And he was kind of the founder, Rabbi Lavut, of the Nikolaev Jewish community. And together, Refalovich and Rabbi Lavut, the Rabbi's great-grandfather, really brought a tremendous amount of Jews. Even during the time it was a closed city, they succeeded in building a Jewish community by Refalovich officially giving these Jews jobs in his shipyard. And when you fast forward 100 years or so, it's fascinating to see that when the Rebbe came to the United States, the Rebbe actually worked in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And that was his, the Rebbe said that that was his contribution, his thank you to the United States for having saved him from the ravages of World War II, and his contribution to the war effort at the time. You know, so suddenly when you see the context that he grew up in a shipbuilding city and his great-grandfather was involved kind of with a shipbuilder, and that was his cover for coming to the city, it's a really interesting circle to close. So we found the documents for all this in the government archives in the city.
Ah, that's actually fascinating. I never realized. Perhaps the Rebbe, why he chose to get his doctorate in nautical engineering of all subjects, was because of this, the things that happened at his youth. He was fascinated with the boats that they were building.
Yeah, just a little note on that. The Rebbe's degree was mechanical and electrical engineering. He also, in Russia, he studied marine engineering, he writes, but his degree was in mechanical and electrical engineering.
Okay. Now, so when you're the director of GEM, so that means everything basically comes back to you, and you're like, the buck stops there. When you're looking through all this material, does anything like raise your eyebrows and go, "Wow, I didn't know that"?
Well, I mean, there are a number of new things that we learned. You know, I'll give you another one, which is we knew that the Rebbe had another teacher. There's one teacher who's very well known, Rabbi Zalman Vilenkin. He taught the Rebbe as a child for 4.5 years, from about his 9th birthday through till a little bit before Bar Mitzvah.
Mm-hmm.
But we knew that there was somebody else. The Rebbe called this other teacher a great Torah scholar, and even said that there was a teacher who lived in his house for a full year. Well, we discovered the identity of this person actually just in the last year as we were finishing up with the book. And he was actually a Rosh Yeshiva, a dean of a yeshiva in Lithuania, who fled World War I, and he came to the city, and the Rebbe's father met him in the synagogue and spoke to him, and he saw right away this is a tremendous Torah scholar. He invited him in to come teach his boys, the Rebbe and his two brothers, and he lived in the Rebbe's house for a year, and until he kind of raised his hand and said, "I have nothing more to teach these boys," and he moved out. But that was one of the many interesting pieces of information.
Mm-hmm.
That
do you have his name?
His name is Rabbi Isser Nissen Dribben, totally unknown until now. And in the book, we actually present his photo, his gravestone, and a biography of him. And even once we knew his name, we were able to find documentation, because as exciting as the find was, we wouldn't be able to include it in the book when we set such a high bar for, you know, documentation only. But once we had his name, we actually went to the archives of the Rebbe's own archives, and we came to them with this name, and they found an incoming letter from Rabbi Dribben's son, and he introduces himself at the beginning of the letter that he's writing to the Rebbe. He says, "I am the son of Rabbi Yisr Nissen Dribben, who taught you in Yekaterinoslav." That was one of a really exciting.
Okay, so explain. Let me just interrupt. So explain. How did you go about? How did the research work that you found out about this hereto unknown teacher of the Rebbe? Give us
a
trail.
That's a great story behind this. So we got a rumor, you know, or somebody tells us that there's this family in Israel that's saying that their grandfather taught the Rebbe. And you know, the first thing your job is to be skeptical, because you know we want to include only information that we know to be true. So Rabbi Levi Greisman, who was the project manager and the chief of research, he was talking to his family in Israel. He had one conversation, another conversation. Then he walks into me one day and he says, "You know, I just got off the phone with them. He's telling me what they were talking about." I said, "Okay, maybe, you know, sounds interesting. Why have we never heard this name before? Fine." And then he said to me something that really kind of stood out. He said, "You know, one of the things this guy mentioned was that his grandfather, who ostensibly taught the Rebbe, had always said that he regretted that he didn't meet the younger brother again. Zeev's youngest brother actually made it to Israel, and he regretted that he didn't meet him again because he was such an engaging, sharp, smart, funny person. And the minute he said that, I said, bingo, this is true. Because how many people would be making up, you know, above him, I said, how many people would be making up a story that their grandfather taught to Lubavitch Rebbe and know enough to know that the Rebbe's youngest brother was tremendously sharp and smart and witty, and that he would say, that the teacher would say, well, I wanted to meet the youngest one again. Because, you know, the Rebbe was much more reserved and introverted and into his studies, you know, from the first day. His younger brother, who had a similar mind, Label was his name, was much more outgoing and witty like that. So that was the story behind how we figured out that was true. Once we dug a little deeper, like I said, we managed to even find the documentation proving it. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay, again, if you're just joining us, our guest today is Elkanah Shmatkin from Jewish Education Media. They've just come out with a book called The Early Years, The Formative Years of the Rebbe, Menachem Mendel Schneerson, as told by documents and archival data. This book goes up to 1929, and the Rebbe became Rebbe in 1951. So I'm assuming then there's going to be a volume two of the early years, Elkanah?
That's the theory. This was a huge, this project really took on a life of its own, and we thought that one volume, you know, when we started, we thought the amount of documentation that there is from the Rebbe's birth till the Rebbe and the Rebbetzin, the Rebbe's wife, arrive in the United States in 1941 would maybe be enough to fill one volume. In the end, as we really rolled up our sleeves and got into it, we have a 550-page volume here from birth, 1902 through 1929. But the theory is that the project will extend all the way until they arrive in the United States. And we've done we do have a tremendous amount of new data and research on the later period as well. So I guess the short answer is, yes, hopefully we will continue it. It's just a really big project, and I hope we'll have the wherewithal to keep doing it.
Okay, that's wonderful. I'm just looking through all of this stuff, and the pictures are actually fascinating, and I didn't notice, like, photo credits and things like that. But you have some pretty really old photographs. Where did you find – I mean, documents are kept in archives in city halls and whatnot. Where did you find photographs like these?
A number of the photographs were brought to us by different individuals. You know, once you're doing a project like this for so long and you're being so meticulous to reach out and get the story right, people start hearing about it. And various individuals, families, archives, you know, kind of came to us with what they had. And once we were able to verify that it's a genuine photo or document, et cetera, then we included them. We really put a very strong emphasis, if you're holding the book, you'll see it. We put a very strong emphasis on including as many original documents as possible. And even on the design and the printing, we put we really invested a lot into it to make sure that you're really getting to, you feel like you could reach out and touch the document and examine it for yourself as though you're holding this, you know, fraying, musty old document in your own hands. So that's really a big part of what we did here, was to make sure to include beautiful reproductions of the original documents and photos.
Yeah, I'm actually amazed at the technology, because some of these very old documents that are old and frayed, you've reproduced them such you could actually read them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hat tip to our designers who really did a yeoman's job on this. But it was that effort on its own, and specifically finding very high quality photos and getting really good reproductions of the photos of the documents was really a huge part of the effort as well.
You mentioned it took a long time. How long did it take from the concept, let's do this book, to publication?
Well, if you look at the whole project, it was 15 years. Once it became clear in our minds that we're doing a book, it was probably about 7 or 6. But the whole research project started really 15 years ago. After a while, it became clear, you know, we must do a book. It's just such fascinating material, and most of it people don't know. And we've got to share this story. It's too good not to. That became really clear in our minds, I'm going to say, about 6 or 7 years ago.
Uh-huh. So, but the next one, when it does indeed come out, it's not going to take 15 or 6 years, because you're halfway through already with most of that. Is there a lot of research yet to be done on number, volume number two?
So you know what happens? It's when you're working to publish something, to finish it, that's when you really see that, you know what, there's something here that doesn't add up, or it doesn't match, or it doesn't gel with what we thought the story was. And that's when you go back for another round and another round. You say, and oh, okay, here's what happened. And then what happens is it changes what you thought about maybe a different story or a different document. So you go back and you do another round on that, and then you come to a deeper understanding. So I could tell you now, no, we have it all, because we think we do have a ton, and there is, we think we understand it. But when you're really working, sometimes it takes until, you know, the book features a whole bunch of beautiful maps. Every city that the Rebbe was, and the Rebbetzin were in, there's a map and the major locations, etc. Sometimes it was like we literally thought we were on the way to print and we're just finishing up a map, and that opened a whole new line of inquiry, etc. So the same thing here. I would say we have a tremendous amount of material, but it's once you're really getting it to the finish line that often sends you around for a loop to find something else, or to find a mistake in the thinking or something like that. So there's a lot, but I'm sure there's a lot to do. The Rebbe seems to have left us lifetimes of work in unpacking his life. And I say this not only about the early years, but in all the work that we're doing. There's really lifetimes of work here to unpack it. So we got our work cut out for us.
Mm-hmm. What part or percentage, or is there a part or percentage you could say, that's actually sitting in the Rebbe's library, which is in Brooklyn, that you don't have to go traveling to the ends of the world?
Well, I don't know how to say percentage-wise. I would say that they were tremendously helpful to us. It took a few years, you know, of us working on this project. But once they saw how serious the work we're doing and how serious we're taking the whole thing, it kind of gave them an injection, you know, gave them a good push to really go the extra mile or the extra bunch of miles for this project. But like I said, you need to know how to look for the materials. Like I was telling you about the story with the Rebbe's teacher. Well, fine, that was sitting there for years, but no one knew what to look for, so it's amongst millions of other documents. The minute we had a name attached to it and we, you know, we had a suspicion about something, then they were able to go through their own research and come back with this document. So many times you could be sitting on a document and not understand its significance or not know what to look for until you've done a lot of other work. So there are certainly many documents there. They've been very helpful. They've given us many documents. But it's once you're digging and curating and presenting the material often that you come back around to a new understanding, and then you can find more based on that.
Okay. Now, Jewish Education Media, GEM, has a website. I'm assuming it's gem.org, from what I recall.
JEmedia.org.
JEmedia.
About the book specifically, that's available at gemstore.com.
Okay.
Gemstore.com.
What other things, since you've piqued people's interests, Rabbi Shmutkin, what other things does GEM offer?
Well, we have, as I mentioned, we have the Living Torahs, the weekly video that comes out. We actually have an app in both Android and iOS called Living Torah. And you can sign up for that at livingtorah.org. You can actually get a membership at livingtorah.org and then download the app. There are thousands of videos available and indexed by name, by date, by topic, and people seem to find that a fascinating way to really interact with and engage with the Rebbe's inspiration in these really nice videos.
Cool. Any Rebbe t-shirts?
No, we don't do that.
You don't do shirts. Okay. So that would be cool. Anyway, so our guest today has been Rabbi Elkanah Shmutkin. He's the director of GEM. If you want to learn more about early years, the formative years of the Rebbe Menachem Schneerson, as told by documents and archival data, 1902 to 1929, go to JE Media, that's GEM Media, and .org, and look it up. And we want to thank you so much, Elkanah, for coming on and sharing this with us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, take care. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. Want assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Herr Schulfenman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have a little bit of klezmer music coming up. I know a lot of people like klezmer. This is ahara, which is a type of a dance. And there's like specific songs that people dance the hara to now, which they think that's the only one they do. But it's a type of a dance, which is, it's like saying like the foxtrot or the jitterbug was only done to like a specific song when it wasn't. It was just a certain beat and style. So this is the Rakija. I hope I'm saying that correctly because I don't speak Bulgarian. The Rakija Klezmer Orchestra from Bulgaria, and the piece is called Hara. Or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. We got time for one more. This is Eitan Freilich. Freilich means happy, by the way. And my mother always said, don't comment about people's last names, but it's divine providence. This is Adar, the first day of Adar. And it says, Mishenichnas ba'Adar marbin b'simcha. When Adar comes in, we have to increase in joy because of the upcoming holiday of Purim. So, Eitan Freilich, we happen to pick you by a little divine intervention. This is Am Yisrael, my people Israel.
לפעמים קשה, צריך נחמה, מתפשט הפחד, ממלא את הנשמה, לא קל להתמודד, פתאום עכשיו תקווה.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Herschel Finman, who you are listening to the Jewish Hour. Koren Publishers has come out with a trove,
I'm not even saying a veritable trove. It is a trove of books recently, and we're going to talk about all of them. It's five titles totally. Okay. First one is the next edition, the next volume of the Koran Talmud, the English translation. This is Baba Basra, Volume 1. It'll be complete in two volumes. This deals with, like, neighbors, laws type things, like fences, how high you can build buildings, zoning laws, fascinating stuff. You don't have to be an urban planner or civil engineer. But I have actually learned Baba Basra with some people who were civil engineers and just, like, amazed, like, wow, all the things that could possibly happen. It's all discussed, and they do a dynamite job. It's like two thumbs up for that. The next thing that came out, there's a new edition of Rashi, Chumash with Rashi. It's five volumes, or you can get the one-volume set. I requested the one-volume set, and it has now become the volume, the Chumash, which I use to follow along the Torah reading. I keep it in my locker at the synagogue and follow it along, because the deal with this is it's precise, it's accurate, it's 100%, it's right there, and I can feel that when the person's reading the Torah that I'm like right there, and it's just like it's the best thing I've had for doing that. I don't like the font that they have for the Rashi script, but I manage with it. The Haftorah is a little bit small. I give it 4 out of 5. Definitely, I call it a buy. The next one is by Rabbi Shlomo Raz. He's done some stuff before. This is Stories of Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Berdichev. We told many stories about Levi Yitzchak Berdichev, and the stories are really good. Translation a little bit. I would have liked it if the person would have like looked at the story and then told it over in their own words rather than saying like translating it. I don't find it as enjoyable, but again, I give it like 3.5 stars on that one. Then there's also things that I just got. One of them is called The Books of the People, Revisiting Classic Works of Jewish Thought by Stuart Halperin. And this is, there's lots of books that have been written since about, I would say, the 700s that Jews are called the people of the book and really into the various things and books. And he gives a good oversight of it. And I really like this tome. This one is going to sit on the shelf for a while. And then the continuing thing Karin has been doing has been insights into the Bible. And the next one that came out, this is actually Magid Press, which is a subdivision of Koran, is Textual Tapestries, Exploration of the Five Megillot. The Five Megillot are found in the Hagiographia. They are the five books of which are read around the holidays time. They include Song of Songs, the Book of Ruth, the Book of Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, and Esther. And this is, it's coming up to the, we're in the Purim time now. So there's really some very way cool things going on here about the language, for example, the Book of Esther, what was the importance of women in the Bible, and how unsexist Judaism really is, comes really, really through. Gabriel Cohen did a dynamite job, and I give those two definitely buys. So if you want to catch them, I would say go to Koran Pub, I think is the website, and go to Amazon, of course, and you'll keep you busy for a while. It's like people come into my house and they say, wow, look at all these books. And I say, keeps me off the streets at night. So this week is the portion of Teruma. It can be found in the book of Exodus, chapter 26. We're not actually done with stories. We've got another major story coming up in 2 weeks, and that would be the story of the golden calf. But in this week and next week, we are building the sanctuary, which were the, you might say, the cure for the golden calf. The rule is in Judaism that God provides the cure before the malaise. So one of the things, every detail, I mean, you could say there's a lot of press on this. I mean, talking Torahs are handwritten, and there's four entire portions which are dedicated to the describing the building of the sanctuary in the desert, which we don't have. we don't use. It has no practical application as far as busy building the thing, because we're not even allowed to build one of these things with all these details that are given. But the details are definitely worth discussing. We have, for example, there was a curtains that went over the top of this portable sanctuary. It was a wooden structure, and over the top of it was with no roof. And the roof was made out of these tapestries. And the tapestries were made out of red, blue, purple wool, and white linen. And you ask the significance, you know, about this stuff. If you take all those colors, you kind of twine them all together, what you get is kind of like this reddish brown. So why didn't they just use reddish brown for it? They could have, listen, if they're dyeing already, so dye it reddish brown if you want it reddish brown. So a very interesting thing, though, is because no, it's not one thing. It's an amalgam, as we, people, are amalgam. It says red, which is to remind us of fire, is indicative of the fiery love that a person should have for the Almighty. I tell people, ideally, you should be having a passionate love affair with the Almighty. Not even joking. Blue is a sense of the sky. It was like a lighter blue. So it's like sky blue to remind us of the sky. And when we look up at the sky, especially like at night, and we see all the stars, and how humbling an experience that is. We look up and we see 4 trillion stars and how much space that takes up and how insignificant we each are. That has a very humbling effect on us and creates a sense of awe of the Almighty. Purple is a mixture between red and blue. So what that indicates is rahmanis, mercy. We would like the Almighty to have mercy on us. Give us some slack. Give us what we need. Likewise, this is the best vehicle for conveying divine mercy is when we show mercy on others. That doesn't mean that we have to make ourselves like an old rag. It means give what's needed. Give appropriately. And then finally, white, which is really the absence of color, is now conveying our self-sacrifice. Because bottom line, the job has to get done. And that's really what it's all about. It's very much the just go and do it. Speaking of doing it, we're going to take a quick commercial break and we're going to be right back with the Hasidic story. Don't go away. You're listening to the Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard. The Specs Howard School of Media Arts is proud to have been a sponsor of the Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding comes from its sponsors, listeners like you help keep the Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to the Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. That's 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. Your help is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? RabbiFinman.com, RabbiFinman.com. You'll find a way to contact me right on the homepage. Don't have to go looking. We do that for your convenience. You'll also find archived editions of the show. If you missed anything, want to hear something again, want to do some binge listening, 55 episodes of the Jewish Hour to keep you busy. That's 55 hours. That's like 2 days and plus. You could just sit there. It'd be a wonderful thing. Just write, let me know how you feel afterwards. Then, in addition, we have the Hasidic U Parsha, the Hasidic U story, the U Parsha, the Hasidic, the E Parsha, all of which in media in which I convey information and about Judaism, hopefully in an entertaining way. The very important donations page, of course, which that is the keeps us going. We Baruch Hashem, we paid for December. March is coming up next week already. It's this week already is March. So help us out. Please do it. Don't like doing internet giving? Fine. Go to, send your donations to The Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. I am checking the old address, and I haven't gotten anything there for quite a while, so people are picking up. I'm glad to hear you're listening. 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, 48220, and we need you. The story There's a woman who about 100 years ago, maybe a little less than 100 years ago, lived in the city of Dvinsk, Poland, and had this phenomena with a newborn, little kid, a couple months old. The baby wouldn't nurse on Shabbos. It was really weird. 6 days a week, the kid nursed. Comes along the Shabbos, kid wouldn't nurse. So she went to doctors. Doctors checked the kid. Everything seems fine. She said, well, it involves a Shabbos, so I'm going to go ask the rabbi. So she went to the Or Sameach, who was the name of the, that was the book that he wrote, the this illustrious rabbi, and asked the problem. And he said, this sounds like something you should go ask the Rugachever, who was another rabbi in town, who was brilliant. He was actually the person who ordained the Rebbe, gave him ordination. She went and asked him the question and asked, what's the gives? So she said, he said, this is a man who spoke in footnotes. So he told her to go back to the first rabbi, who was an expert in Jerusalem Talmud, and said, look in this place in Jerusalem Talmud, and your answer will be there. So the rabbi looked over there, and found that it was talking about an ox that gored only on Shabbos. And the question is, how come the ox only gored on Shabbos? It says because people were wearing different clothing, so the ox got scared. So that's what he understood. He said to the woman, dress in your regular clothing. Don't wear your special Shabbos clothing when you're nursing the baby. And they all lived happily ever after. That's going to do it for us. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. Remember, it's Otter time to increase in Simcha. And we hope to see you back again next week. Take care.